how monarchs find these little patches of land is very interesting, and it's not completely known. One of the things we know is that monarchs are very good at sensing with their eyes. Their vision is different than ours. They actually see a wider portion of wavelengths than we can. They can see shorter wavelengths than we can, so more into the ultraviolet and infrared, so longer wavelengths. So they have a broader visual field than we as humans do. Their world is faceted. It's a different kind of vision, but it's good vision. So we know that monarchs can see milkweed plants from a fairly long distance. And then when they get closer to them, they can smell them. What we don't know is the distance from which monarchs can perceive milkweed. It could be that they perceive a likely habitat, say a grassland, and that's something that they can see from a very long distance. And then they come in and get closer and find the milkweed. So we're not sure of the details of how they perceive their world, but we do know that they can perceive it very well. A lot of times people will say to me, it's just amazing that a monarch can find one milkweed plant in a big field. And I'll say, well, I can find one milkweed plant in a big field, and my reproductive success doesn't depend on it. So it shouldn't be surprising to us that they can find this milkweed, but it would be really interesting to know the details of how they do it. So there have been some experiments done, but nobody's been able to figure out how their perception works. We can study habitats of different sizes and habitats that are embedded in different kinds of landscapes. So for example, we did a study in southern Wisconsin, a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, and I and another faculty member and several undergraduates did a study where we went to a lot of different habitats of different sizes. We chose some habitats that had a lot of grasslands near them and some that were just isolated little patches. What we found is that on an acre by acre scale, we would find more monarchs in the isolated patches. So what that says to us is that they are able to perceive them from a fairly long distance, and that they can kind of, if a whole bunch of monarchs are flying over an area that doesn't have a lot of good habitat, they will all be able to converge on this good habitat. So you see a higher density of monarchs in an area that's surrounded by monarch wasteland, like cornfields or soybeans or roads or city. So they are able to perceive, you know, I'm going to use the word perceive instead of see because we don't know exactly how they're finding it, but they can find these isolated patches. And the size doesn't matter, that they'll find a small isolated patch or a large isolated patch with fairly equal probability. So that tells us some things about how if we have limited conservation dollars, which we do, and if we want to think on a large scale about where we would get the most bang for our buck in terms of putting in habitat, it would be better, acre for acre and dollar for dollar, to put our money into isolated habitat. But that's kind of an interesting trade-off. In some ways, you know, maybe the person that owns that isolated habitat isn't interested in changing it into good monarch habitat. So we have to think about who owns the land, what the possibilities are for getting the land into good habitat. And then, because we care about a lot of other organisms as well, we think about the value of that habitat on a large scale for conservation. And for a lot of organisms, large connected areas are better. So I don't want people to get too tied up into thinking, well, our work showed that we should really focus on these small isolated habitats, because A, that's not always practical, and B, there are a lot of other organisms that would benefit more from connectivity, from connected habitats. So I guess my theory of habitat conservation is we should do it wherever we can.